Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming. We have a few things on the agenda today, but what we are going to actually start with right now is we're going to actually start with the vital signs report in the interim, and then we're going to come back once we have a quorum here, okay? But we do want to get started in the interest of people's time and what we have going on today. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start off with a brief safety contact. In case of an emergency, the exits are located to the rear of this room and also to the front. There's also fire extinguishers out there. The closest one is behind these two doors. In event of an emergency, we're going to assemble across the street at the building museum. AEDs are located behind the guard booth. As you exit through the lobby, there's also restrooms back there if anyone needs one. Today's topic is back to school means sharing the road. The back to school season means added congestion on our area roadways, which comes in the form of both vehicular and pedestrian traffic. According to the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, autumn is the most dangerous time of the year for pedestrians. Approximately 29% of all pedestrian-related fatalities occur during this time of the year. Below are some tips to help you navigate the back-to-school season. Slow down in school zone in areas where buses are pulled over. Cover the brake pedal with your foot while scanning the roadway for pedestrians. Remember, passengers can rapidly appear from the front of a bus and move into oncoming traffic. Keep a lookout for groups of children walking to and from school as they can change direction quickly and dart into traffic unexpectedly. Watch out for bicycles. Slow down and allow at least 3 feet for passing distance between your vehicle and a bicycle. Always keep an eye out for bicyclists in hot spots like marked school zones, bike lanes, and near bus stops. Be on the lookout for inexperienced drivers. Keep in mind that a higher than normal number of motorists you encounter at this time of year are teen drivers that may be heading to school, home, or to after-school activities. Everyone have a good day.
Thank you very much, sir. As I said, we are not going to actually start with the official meeting, but what we can do is start with some of the informational items. The first one is the quarterly update, vital signs, and key performances. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Andrea Burnside, the Acting Chief of Assurance Quality and Performance, and today I'm going to be presenting the performance results for the second quarter of calendar year 2016. That covers the months of April, May, and June. Let's start with the safety and security results. Looking at customers all the way over to the left there, at 2.1 injuries per million passengers, the customer injury rate was above our target this quarter. If we break that down by mode, we see that bus customer injuries fell slightly by 4% compared to last year. We saw fewer customers injured in collisions and while boarding and alighting the bus. Bus continues to coach our staff to employ defensive driving tactics and holding safety blitzes at accident hotspots. Rail injuries stayed about the same as last year, and the good news is we had no customer injuries associated with the Safe Track activities in June at those stations. The rate for access customers is what drove this result, and that rose by 77%. We saw more non-collision related injuries, essentially related to providing our door-to-door passenger assistance. What we're doing is improving our training on assisting customers who have difficulty maintaining balance. And we also basically just have better data, so sometimes that changes results as we've improved our business process for reporting and data analytics. Looking at employees in the middle there, we averaged 5.4, worse than target and higher than last year. Some key drivers of this increase are collisions, which were mostly non-preventable, and struck by and against injuries. And on the latter type of injuries, we're finding that many of those are because employees are not wearing personal protective equipment as they should be, and that's determined as a factor in some of these incidents. Physical assaults and stress injuries in total more than doubled compared to last year, although if you just look at bus operator assaults, we have lower year-to-date assaults than we did last year. This primarily impacts bus operators, and installing bus shields across the fleet continues. That's an important safety initiative. My understanding is we've installed 421 bus shields through July. Okay, moving all the way to the right to crime. Crime rate is on target, but it is worse than last year, which last year was at 4.7 per million passengers. It's somewhat of a mixed bag, so we saw snatches down 54%. That's significant, but we also saw parking lot crime go up due to more thefts from automobiles and parking garages. Aggravated assaults were often related to arguments between juveniles. Some strategies we're employing are partnering with local agencies and setting up to set up parking patrols. Officers are also distributing a pamphlet to customers who leave things out in their cars and in sight. You know, you'd be surprised sometimes people leave like cash in their middle console. So they have the Don't Make It Easy pamphlets that they put on cars just to remind people to be cautious. We've also added 10 uniformed officers to high visibility patrols at hotspot stations. And also BUS is partnering with MTPD on to focus officers on those routes that have the highest frequency fare evasion. As we've talked to the committee about before, bus operator assault is often related to fare evasion. Moving to the next results for BUS. BUS on-time performance was at 76%, was slightly lower than last year due to an increase in late arrivals, particularly in June. We all know what happened in June. We initiated the SafeTrack program, and that did begin to impact bus on-time performance. As rail customers who are seeking different ways of getting around increased bus ridership, which went up by about 10% near the SafeTrack activity, and that added to bus boarding and alighting time. And customers also chose to drive due to SafeTrack, and because buses compete with cars, so the streets got more congested, so the buses were a little more delayed, and it increased bus travel times. Some actions to address this include monitoring our garage pullouts and doing some on-the-spot verifications and monitoring pullout reports. Quarter two was a strong quarter for bus reliability. That's really good news because over the past couple years, we've been talking about some of the challenges we've had with bus manufacturers. It's an industry-wide problem. And because of all the focused work on that, we've actually seen a really good result this quarter. So all these proactive actions are starting to pay off. And I think we've seen the best reliability since quarter two of 2013. So a nice uptick in bus reliability. Bus customer satisfaction didn't meet our target, but it did remain steady and consistent with quarter two of last year. Bus customers are reporting increased MTPD visibility, as I mentioned earlier, with the increased patrols, and that's an important factor when we survey customers as to their experience. On rail, moving to rail slide, please. Thank you. 74% of trips made by Metrorail customers were on time in the quarter. Performance was highest in April, 80%, as track work was limited during cherry blossoms season. May saw the lowest performance of the quarter, 69%, as track work resumed and unplanned disruptions added to customer travel times. Despite safe track on the orange, blue, and silver lines in June, customer on-time performance rebounded slightly to 71%. Without SafeTrack, customer on-time performance would have been around 75% in June. One of the questions I was asked, I guess in response to a briefing on this, was how could the orange line, if you look at page 39 in the detailed charts, even with SafeTrack orange line customers achieve 50%, that seemed high to someone. Basically, we tried to address and isolate the impact of the surges. For example, on surge one, we added extra orange line trains between Boston and Vienna. So the brunt of the impact is really felt during the peak period. If you drill down into the peak periods on surge one, the overall on-time performance on orange line was 29%. So it just depends how you look at it. Rail fleet reliability in the middle there demonstrated strong performance in the quarter, 35% better than a year ago, as our 1,000, 6,000, 7,000 series cars averaged over 100,000 miles between delays. Mild weather in May contributed to better performance and parts availability improved compared to last year. Strong reliability translated to good car availability, meaning we have enough cars to put trains together to get the service out in the morning. With the daily car requirement was met each day in April and May. Car availability did decline in June as car rebalancing for SafeTrack led to more cars at some shops than could be accommodated, creating a backlog of cars needing repairs. To improve performance, we've implemented a number of initiatives, improving repair quality through mechanic training, targeting campaigns to drive down the most frequent types of failure, streamlining parts planning and procurement, as we've talked about before, and reducing repair times. We continue to receive and conditionally accept our 7,000 series rail cars. As of this reporting period, we had 44 new cars placed in service in the quarter, And with those already out there, we've added up to 17 trains in service by the end of June. For the past 4 months, we've improved the delivery schedule for the 7Ks to 16 cars a month. Rail customer satisfaction all the way to the right saw a steady decline as customer perception of reliability declined for the quarter. To address this, we continuing, obviously, all the improvement plans we have in place with track, power, and rail car. We've also been addressing some other drivers of customer satisfaction, so we know some of the components that drive satisfaction. And those would include the environments at the rail stations, like signage, lighting, and ceilings, and implementing same station entry and exit. 15-minute grace period has been well received by customers. Elevator and escalator results were near target. This elevator availability was near target, and escalator availability exceeded target. Actions to improve included continuing our modernization program, enhancing remote monitoring so that outages can be identified and resolved faster, and allocating staff to stations that are most impacted by SafeTrack so that we can respond to any outages. There are about 10 to 12 stations, so folks look at this result and say, on my trip, I see a number of escalators not working, so my experience is not this. And of course, this is a system-wide measure, so there are actually about 10 to 12 stations where escalator availability doesn't meet target. This is often due to scheduled maintenance, and I believe there's a detail kind of on that in the appendix of your package. Okay, SafeTrack. Surges started in June, as we all know, near the end of this reporting period. You can see an example of how we are displaying results for the SafeTrack program on WMATA.com. And over to the left, it includes the percent, and then to the right, the number of different components completed during the surge. SafeTrack is having a pervasive impact on customers, obviously on rail, as we know that's very specific, but also on bus, as I mentioned. Looking at the Transportation Planning Board, they found that travel time has increased by 30% on many district routes for cars as well as buses, so that means about half of our bus customers are impacted by SafeTrack as well. Okay, last slide here, my trip time. So although it's a little bit outside the reporting period of the quarter, I'm happy to announce that we did launch My Trip Time in July. And this gives the customers the ability to sign up to get with their Smart Trip card to get their own personalized travel summary. So what you can see if you sign up is a 3-month summary of your overall on-time score, how many trips you've made, how many miles you've traveled on Metro during the period, how long your travel should take according to the standards the board has set. And there's a range because you can either catch the train right as you come to the platform or you may have to wait, a headway for the next train to come. That's why there's a range. And then how you can look at how long it takes on average. There's also kind of your fastest time and your slowest time. And a really great thing is if you're wondering, like, why did that one day take me 90 minutes when it should have taken me 30, you can actually drill down into our delay reports for that day and find out what happened during the time you were traveling. You know, perhaps there was a door problem or a missed dispatch or something of that nature. So you could kind of do your own research into what happened to your trip that day. And that concludes my presentation. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Does anyone have any questions on the report? Yes, sir.
Just a short question. How many people are using My Trip Time now?
I have not looked at how many people have signed up. Do you know that? No. We can research that and find out. We're trying to get the word out there to everyone, including our own employees, because we can use our badge to sign up as well.
Good morning, Ms. Burnside. Ms. Burnside, I just want to drill down on one particular issue from the Vital Signs report in your presentation this morning, and that's the availability of rail cars, where we need, what's the number, 954 on a daily basis to meet peak period needs. And you alluded in your presentation what's on page 25 of the Vital Signs report, which is that car availability was good or up in April and May, but then availability declined in June. And that's on page 25. But then I find two inconsistent statements further on page 26, where it says that while average weekday rush hour ridership at maximum load points was down, the same period last year. Fewer rail cars available for service led to crowded rail cars at some locations, suggesting that we weren't hitting the 954. And then there's a further statement, again, back on page 35, if I ever can get there, where you're talking about traction power. And you pointed out that traction power was down, and it was down almost 5% decrease in total rail car revenue miles, stemming from decreased in rail car availability. So it seems as though there's something inconsistent. So could you perhaps try to clarify that as to what months we met the 954 target and where we didn't and what the whole year looked like?
Sure. So I think on the rail crowding page you mentioned where it said the talking about our load points was down from the same period due to fewer rail cars available for service. It does look like maybe we're reporting on a slightly different period than we are in the other quarter due to availability of data. So that could be one of the explanations for that, but I can look into that further for that explanation.
So where are we? Are we now, because you indicate that in June, because of this rejigging of the rail cars, we weren't providing 954. Are we providing 954 according to the data through the summer, and are we providing 954 per day now in September? Mr. Letter, I guess she's passing the baton to you, I guess.
No, I just, well, although Angie has the luxury of providing the vital signs report, really it falls under my area. Based on the track surges, that 954 is not always accurate. So in June, in our first couple track surges, we actually had less cars needed to run service because we had reduced service on that line. Okay, so just want to make sure 954, if there is no track work going on, no track surges going on, that 954 is currently what we project on a regular basis. I know in the summer months, in June and July, we had a tough time with some reliability of our fleet, basically with our HVAC. But in the last few days, we're back up to our 954 number right now. Have we had some reliability issues with the cars? Absolutely. And we're working on trying to correct that. And we have some initiatives that we are working on, not only with the HVAC, but also with some of our door issues that we've, encountered. I can't go back in. I don't know the history back in June. But I can tell you, I know in June when these track surges did start, the 954 number was not needed. I forget, we actually dropped down to about 920 or 910, that what we needed to run regular service.
Number we should be focused on now is 920?
Well, right now under this track surge, yes, we should be up to about 954. But as we go into other track surges, depending on where that track surge is, okay, our total car count needed for that day could definitely decrease.
Right.
We could look at, I'm not too sure what's needed.
I'm raising this issue for two reasons. First, the board, I guess about 6 months ago,
yes,
went ahead and changed the competitive bidding rules so that the general manager could buy up parts that were missing, which mm-hmm. was part of the problem, I guess, in keeping the 954 number out there. And I just wanted to understand whether that was working. But then when I came over from Farragut this morning, I noticed on the red line 3 6-car trains in a row. So I'm sort of wondering whether we're really at whatever the number is or whether we're still having a rail car availability problem and whether there's anything that the board should be doing to cure that problem.
Okay. No, I there was, yes, you're right in the sense that the board was asked to assist us back, I think it was in the summer months, to get some parts that were needed. And those parts were on, and we were able to get cars back in. I think what we're dealing with in the legacy fleet is just really the reliability, and the team is constantly working on different initiatives to try and keep those cars in service. And what we're really looking forward to is the 7K series as that, becomes more 7K series cars come on board. We're hoping to see that reliability and availability of the fleet increase.
Thank you.
And as they say, the saying goes, like, a few months doesn't make a trend. As we go into the summer months, although the result for April, May, June is positive on rail fleet reliability, it does go down. So my next report, when I come back in November, you're not going to see as high of a result, unfortunately. Summer months is brutal on the rail cars.
Thank you, Mr. Augustine. Mr. Letter, this is probably for you. I'm focused on the bus on-time performance KPIs, which are in, I'm looking first at page 38 in our book. And the on-time performance by time period looks interesting to me, and I wonder if you had any thoughts on why this is the case. We don't really meet targets at all after the AM periods, except for the month of February. So that includes both the midday and also the late night, where we're consistently below target, whereas in the early AM and also the AM peak, we meet targets consistently. Do we have any thoughts as to why that is? It seems somewhat counterintuitive.
I think I'm going to have to get back to you on that.
That's fine. Okay?
I mean, I would have to go back and look at history. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times what will happen is, I know, as Angie has mentioned, SafeTrack has definitely probably put more people in cars and has affected it. But I really would have to go back and look at a historical look to see is it somewhat seasonal that's causing it and stuff like that. And I'm not familiar with, the traffic patterns here. Yeah. To be able to really give you a great explanation. But I'll look into it and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, I think as you noted, the anomaly is kind of late night. Why aren't they more on time during the late night? Makes sense early in the morning because there's fewer traffic, less traffic before, say, 9 a.m., and then everybody jumps on the road, and then performance goes down in the midday. Midday includes 9 a.m., so kind of that late. If you look at the time frame, midday is 9 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Yeah.
It's a really wide span of time. There's a lot of people traveling on the roads during that time, competing with the bus. To me, the anomaly is the late night.
Sure.
And we can look into why that might be from an operational point of view, what's going on.
Yeah, you'd expect late night to look a lot like the early AM, and surprising that the AM peak were meeting targets, which is also a huge crush point. So, any insights that you can have in future months would be appreciated. And one more, if I can, Mr. Augustine, on the next page, 39, we look at the bus fleet reliability by fuel type, and generally it seems to be consistent for each fuel type, and again, very cognizant of 1 month not being a trend, but do we have any sense as to why there's a little bit more variability in the reliability of the clean diesel fleet, where the variation seemed to be a little bit larger than they are for the other fuel types?
Yeah, I would say, 1 month does make a trend, and also the clean diesel is some of our oldest fleet,
okay.
So I know 1 month isn't that much older, but we can look into the specifics, but generally I would say 1 month doesn't make a trend. Sometimes there's just an anomaly, like a particular component that they're replacing or something.
But the clean diesel fleet is a little bit older on average than the others? Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. The only comment that I would make on this report is that, as I mentioned the last time, I'm drawn to the customer satisfaction number, which in the beginning of this report shows that in 2013, the second quarter, the customer satisfaction for rail was 86%, and now we find ourselves at 66%, and that has to change. We're going to have to turn that number around. And all of this obviously feeds into that. That's absolutely critical that we concentrate on that number. Now that we have a quorum, I'd like to actually call this meeting to order. And we can start with an approval of the agenda. Does somebody make a motion? Can I get a second? All right, can I get a second? Yeah, I know. Christian, do you mind? Can I get a second? You're filling in. You're the only Virginian. Yes, you are. Okay, thank you. All those in favor, say my aye. Opposed? Okay, hearing none. We also look for And approval of the minutes from the last meeting. And in that case, that is going to have to come from us that we're here. So can I get some motion? Can I get a second? Yeah, can we actually do that since if I? Okay, all right, great. All those in favor? Aye. Opposed? None, okay. As we move forward, our next presentation actually for the day is going to be from Christian Kent on the Abilities Ride program. After that, we're going to have the final agenda item of the day, which is going to be a discussion about the number of hours that we have authorized. And we're going to talk about the authorization of a public hearing for the proposal on those hours changes. And then we're going to have public outreach. We're going to talk about public outreach, which will also provide information for customers on proposed Metro bus service for late night customers. While Metro has temporarily reduced rail service hours during SafeTrack, any long-term changes require public outreach process and ultimately board approval. If the committee acts today, its action would only be the first step in the decision-making process. And now we'll turn it over to Mr. Kent.
Thank you and good morning. Today's presentation is an information item on Abilities Ride, which is the latest in a set of alternatives to Metro Access paratransit service that Metro would like to offer to our paratransit customers. I know at least one of our board members this morning recalls the discussion when we first started talking about this, but Mr. Goldman had asked us back during the 2015 budget process to look into ways of leveraging the advent of transportation network companies to help with the sustainability of our paratransit service, Metro Access. And we went through a fairly elaborate stakeholder vetting process on this because clearly any change to the service or any new services that we put out to the disability community have to be tailored, and it was very important to us to have a sense of what the requirements would be for this type of service. So we worked very extensively with our Accessibility Advisory Committee and had quite a bit of dialogue even within our industry with peers, with peer transit agencies, to come up with this concept of Abilities Ride that you're going to be seeing today. Essentially, what we are attempting to do is exactly what we had discussed originally, which is to subsidize an existing transportation option that will allow Metro Access customers to voluntarily choose this service, you know, in addition to or instead of Metro Access as they see fit. All Metro Access customers who have been approved through our eligibility process will be able to use Ability Ride, and the procurement that's going to ensue, we're planning on putting out a solicitation, you know, very soon on this, may involve partnering with multiple providers. I know the slide says will, but you know, I think may is a more accurate portrayal of this because it really does depend on what the response is. But we will tell you in the next few slides exactly what we're going to be asking of interested vendors. The service will initially be limited to Maryland, and we chose Maryland mainly because the majority of Metro Access service is delivered in Maryland. I think, you know, it's worth noting that in Virginia and in the District of Columbia that our paratransit customers often have more available alternatives than exist in Maryland presently. And so, you know, that's another reason why the demand for Metro Access in Maryland is so high. And so that's clearly where we're beginning to target our efforts. And finally, I'm going to add on the background here that we did include in the scope of work for this solicitation a limit of 4 one-way trips per day on the service. And this is mainly because what we have seen actually in Baltimore, MTA did a program like this called Taxi Access with their local taxi resources, and with the very successful Transport DC program, that when you offer a service that has even greater amenities and more convenience than the available ADA paratransit service, it becomes very popular very quickly. And we want in this pilot phase to be able to have a certain constraint on the growth while we evaluate the effectiveness of the program. It's also important to note that Abilities Ride is going to be viewed as a non-ADA option in this sense, that it is going to be distinguished from Metro Access, the ADA paratransit service. And we are making that distinction for one big reason, which is that the Metro Access service, being the ADA mandated civil right that's afforded to all people with disabilities who qualify, is replete with requirements on levels of performance, reporting, and equity that cause the service to be more expensive than it might otherwise be if we were simply just looking at the cost of transporting someone from origin to destination. And so we're making a distinction here that this is not going to be ADA paratransit service for the following reasons. Participation will be completely voluntary, and again, I mention this again, this is also important to our partners at the FTA, that we make it very clear that Metro Access will continue to be completely available to all eligible customers. There will be no reduction in resources to Metro Access, and customers are free to use Metro Access either concurrently or instead of Abilities Ride as they wish. There will be no impact to paratransit eligibility either. Those are processes that will remain the way they are. And finally, there are no vehicles in the Metro Access fleet that will be used for Abilities Ride. These vehicles will be completely separate. The amenities of the service, this is obviously the nice part of it, that it's going to be attractive to customers because there are amenities on Abilities Ride that are not available on Metro Access. Most importantly, same-day service. When you use paratransit service, you must reserve the trip at least 24 hours in advance, and our policy is up to 7 days. With Abilities Ride, a customer can reserve the trip on the same day of service using an app. So, I mean, it's real time. It's the kind of convenience that we've all heard about that people are now able to use from transportation network companies outside of paratransit, and now it will be available to the disability community through this program. And the cost. Customers will pay $5. They will pay the first $5 of the fare. And if the fare, the total fare, should exceed $20, then the customer would also pay any excess above that $20 threshold. So the fare subsidy per trip is going to be $15. And that enables the service to be still affordable to the customer, but yet there's still a contribution that the customer makes to the cost of the trip. Also, unlike Metro Access, customers can use this service without having to share a ride. So the experience on Abilities Ride can be very different. They'll be able to use an app on the same day they wish to travel, pay the $5 and occasionally a little more, depending on the length and timing of the trip, and they'll be able to ride alone, basically very much like a person would experience if they were to use a taxi or Uber or a similar type of service. Accessibility is also important to this endeavor. We want to make it very clear, as we have to our regulatory partners, that this service, despite what people have heard, is going to have wheelchair access for customers. So it's not going to be an ambulatory-only service. When we put out the solicitation, interested vendors will have to demonstrate the capability of accommodating wheelchair-using customers with their fleets. And, you know, a lot of people have asked, okay, well, how are they going to do that if they don't currently operate that way, or if they don't have their own accessible fleet? And we're going to say, again, you know, being that this is a partnership with the private sector that we trust, that they will be able to, through partnerships or, you know, whatever other means are available to them, to acquire such an accessible fleet so that they can be responsive to those types of requests. So that's going to be a very salient requirement of the solicitation. Additionally, the app that will be used for the service is going to be 508 and compliant with the other applicable regulations that relate to web content, and so that people who use assistive technology when they're working with the internet will be able to access the app for the service as well. Key issues about the quality of the service that we know are a concern to our customers, and of course they're a concern to us. Even though we are not going to be directly operating the service because of the fact that we are sponsoring it and we are regarding it as a Metro program, the drivers will be required to pass background checks. The qualifications of the drivers will be important, as well as they will have to have training on sensitivity and an understanding of how to serve customers with disabilities. And, you know, we also include in here that this is another feature that we think is important. Customers who travel with service animals also need to be accommodated, and that will be a requirement of the solicitation. A question that had been asked before I go to this slide here about the app, our advisory committee tells us that they're going to obviously be people who do not have access to smartphones, and that not everyone is going to have the same ability to use a highly technical solution. We are going to be asking the vendors in the solicitation to demonstrate any telephone reservation capability that they have. You know, and again, what we don't want to do is be too prescriptive about what they must provide. What we're more interested in seeing is how are they going to provide an innovative solution that will serve the entirety of our Metro Access constituency. So that is also, the telephone capability is also going to be a part of our evaluation process. And then finally, the financial impact. We anticipate that between 150 and 250,000 subsidized trips will be taken during the first full year of implementation of this program. And since implementation is not expected to start until March of next year, it's not exactly coincident with the fiscal year, but within the first 12 months, we're anticipating that this is the volume that we expect people will choose Abilities Ride either in addition to or instead of Metro Access. And, you know, the bullet at the bottom says that the range of savings could be anywhere between $4 and $6 million. So, you know, it really is a significant effort on our part to make Metro Access sustainable. You know, and I say to all the interested parties who've been following this issue that this is not simply a matter of trying to make services cost less. This is about us coming to you, as we have in the past, to say that if we don't take actions like these to provide service alternatives, the sheer demand for transportation for people with disabilities is growing at such a rate, with the demographics, population of people living longer, aging baby boomers, advances in medicine, that if we don't do anything, that 10 years from now we could see another million customers on Metro Access. So the sustainability of the service has always been a challenge, but I think, you know, what we're seeing in the societal context is that we need to shift the paradigm from an expectation that WMATA is going to handle all the volume of all kinds of specialized transportation. We are the largest shareholder, but we're not the only one, and we can't be the only one. And in fact, we need to build some new avenues to meet this demand if we want Metro Access to be sustainable. And I would add that as we do that, and customers who do have the ability to take optional services like Abilities Ride, it is going to improve our ability to provide higher quality service on Metro Access, because then we'll be able to concentrate on delivering better customer service to the customers who are not opting for these alternatives. So we feel very good about that. As you can see, the slide shows the per-trip savings that we anticipate and how that's broken out. The subsidy is partly for the fare and partly for any fees that might come from the vendors. So on the last slide, this is our milestone list. And as you can see that, barring any further questions on this, we'd like to issue our solicitation at the end of the month. We intend to have a pre-proposal conference that our advisory committee has expressed interest in attending. We'd very much like to see them there. And then award contracts at the beginning of the year and start service in March. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. Does anyone have any questions regarding this? Ms. Porter?
First of all, I think this is an excellent idea to be piloting, and I think the success of the DC program certainly indicates that this could be successful too. A large part of the success, though, is going to be dependent on the pricing, because you've got a group of customers who are very, very sensitive to price. And so I'm wondering if you could, two questions here, if you could talk a little bit about how you determine the pricing structure. In other words, the initial $5 seems similar to what people would pay in Metro Access. And then where did the $20 come? Are you assuming that most customers won't go over $20? And or are you assuming that most of them will? Or are you assuming that maybe they won't go over 20 because they're all within Maryland? But just if you could talk a little bit about the pricing structure. And then the second question is a customer going to know in real time if their ride is going over $20?
Okay, sure. And I neglected at the beginning of my presentation to introduce my colleague. Mr. Chris Blake is our Director of ADA Policy and Planning. He will be the program manager for Abilities Ride, so I have him supplement my answer on this. But, you know, the Metro Access minimum fare is $3.20. When we saw the taxi access program start in Baltimore, the price per trip was around $3. What we saw, and even, you know, the McKinsey report backs this up also, they called it induced demand, that if it was not market priced or value priced, if you will, then it actually produces new demand, and then we don't accomplish the shift that we were looking for. The average fare that customers pay on Metro Access right now is around $4.85 of the customers who are paying a fare. That's kind of the average.
Right.
It goes as high as $6.50. So you're right that the $5 is similar to what people are paying on Metro Access. I think the inducement, though, to choose Metro or to choose Abilities Ride rather than Metro Access is simply because of those amenities, that you do have to share your ride. You can't have, the same convenience features, and you can't reserve service on the same day. So our thought was that if it was generally in the neighborhood of what customers are currently paying for Metro Access, it's not more expensive than that average, really. That if we're adding a number of amenities, we believe that it's going to track very similarly to what Transport DC has done. And in fact, I believe that $5 was the fare for that program as well. You know, so we have some experience with that. But regarding the $20 trip maximum, I'd like to ask Mr. Blake to answer that part for me.
Good morning. Thank you for your question. We picked the $20 amount in terms of the $5 customer contribution as well as the $15 subsidy because in fiscal year 15, and we're still analyzing for 16, but there were over 900,000 trips from Maryland to Maryland on Metro Access. The average distance of those trips was about 9.2 miles. Doing market research, a 9.2 mile on some of the transportation technology companies would be less than that total 20. Some would be more. So we're looking at a balance of what would we pay and what would the customer pay to cover the average distant trip on an alternative to Metro Access, and that's how we found that $20 balance fare.
So if I could clarify, that means approximately half of the trips you would expect people would end up paying something over, would be end up paying in excess over $20.
In that range, yes. But in terms of their actual out-of-pocket fare, the $5 would cover, with our subsidy, the Metro subsidy, would cover a vast majority of the trips, if those are the trips that are taken.
But you said the average was about 20, which average means like half of them are more and half of them are less?
No, excuse me, the average distance of the trip. So then what we're looking at is the range of how much would companies charge for those fares. So when you look at one company, it's a little less than that. When you look at some other potential vendors, it's a little more than that. So we wanted to come in at a range that would cover, depending on who the vendor or vendors are, would cover the vast majority of the trips.
Okay. All right. And so how would someone know if they were going over the $20 in real time?
Part of the, one of the requirements in the solicitation is the ability of the customer to receive an accurate, fare estimate upon booking a trip.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Augustine. So just a question about how we plan on developing systems to sort of manage some of the requirements of the TNCs with regard to driver certification and background checks. We've known from news items that the TNCs struggle with not necessarily the initial background checks, but making sure that those are maintained and certified on a periodic and predictable basis. Are we foreseeing what we'll need to do at WMATA internally to ensure that they are actually delivering after the initial period the terms that they've agreed to?
Well, yes, and you know, whenever I'm asked that question, I respond by saying that it's fortunate that we have so much experience serving this constituency, because we're going to inform them of exactly what it takes to do this job correctly. Now, obviously, they operate differently in different communities, but if they're going to be under contract to WMATA, then they're going to need to meet our requirements. And, you know, I mean, one of the things we mentioned is the fact that we are going to require wheelchair-accessible vehicles, as an example. So, you know, it's our belief that there's so much volume of business, it's economically worthwhile to them to adapt somewhat to the circumstances that we have here, and the accessibility is part of it, and I think the ability of personnel to properly serve the customer is going to be a part of it. And of course, one thing we also like about this is that it's also driven by customer satisfaction. Customers rate the quality of service that they're getting. And I think that's an important element that's very empowering to the customer, and it's an economic inducement to the vendor.
And so just a quick follow-up in terms of the sensitivity training. I understand that they will be required to provide it. Do we have a sense of what that will be and what the, you know, what follow-up continuing education will be required for drivers who continue? And then the second piece of that, we envision that these companies would be providing access to our Metro Access customers in addition to whatever other ride-sharing responsibilities they would have. And do we have any concerns about their moving back and forth between customers who may require a greater degree of service and sensitivity compared to what might be some other riders that they may be picking up during the course of their workday?
You know, it's a very good question, you know, and the same thing was asked of us with Transport DC. You know, is a taxi operator going to favor, you know, a hailed ride over someone who's within the program? And, you know, I think that the truth of the matter is that the economic inducement of the sheer volume that we're offering in this area is very strong. The other thing, too, is obviously that not meeting the requirements shrinks their ability to really profit from the arrangement. So, you know, I think that's really what we're anticipating. It was not a problem with Transport DC. On your question on sensitivity training, you know, what we are going to do, and is typically our practice, is to let the vendor demonstrate what they feel their best recommendation is. Now, I can tell you, there are commercially available off-the-shelf programs that they could use and just say, you know, we're using this certified program, or they could say, this is an in-house program that we developed. Either way, we will evaluate the content, and we will make sure that it meets our requirements.
Thank you, Mr. Kent. We're running behind schedule, and so in the interest of time, if anyone has any questions, we can absolutely get them to the staff and get them answered for you. Obviously, it's a very important topic, but we are looking to continue this, and we very much appreciate your presentation today, Mr. Kent. We do have another very important matter before us today, which is actually an action item, and Ms. Bowersox is going to make a presentation to us about the possibility for a public hearing for late night service changes. Ms. Bowersox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So today we're seeking authorization to hold the compact required public hearing as part of a robust public outreach effort on proposed changes to the Metro Rail span of service and adjustments to certain late night Metro bus service. As the board is aware, the Safe Track maintenance program changed the closing time for Metro Rail to midnight for a one-year period. And while the intensive Safe Track program is designed to restore the Metro Rail system to a state of good repair, maintaining safe and reliable service will absolutely require more track access moving forward. Returning to 135 hours of service out of every 168 hours a week will not, in fact, be sufficient for maintenance, as management has concluded. The Metro Rail system is too large, complex, and too deep to address existing maintenance needs in such a short window. For years, multiple NTSB and FTA investigations found the need for increased track access. And as you can see on this slide, as recently as this May, an FTA safety directive noted that lack of track access has left WMATA maintenance managers struggling to prioritize work. Track access is needed not just for track work, but for a broad range of maintenance and capital improvement projects that you can see here on this slide, as well as inspections, more numerous now than ever, that require safe access to the right of way. On an ongoing basis, even after Safe Track ends, adequate track time is absolutely required to maintain the rehabilitated tracks and signals, mitigate water intrusion in the tunnels, maintain lighting, fans, and other life safety systems, test and inspect, and conduct training and emergency preparedness activities, all of which require time for tracks to be out of service. The general manager proposed scenario A in July, but after hearing from a number of stakeholders, he directed staff to develop several options. Additional scenarios that have been developed for your consideration demonstrate the give and take required to get us to the goal of 20% increase in the track time for work. Scenario B gives back 1.5 hours on Sunday to close at 11:30 p.m., but closes a half hour earlier on Monday through Thursday at 11:30 p.m. Scenario C gives back an hour on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, where we would then stay open until 1 a.m. on Friday and Saturday and 11 p.m. on Sunday, but closes a half hour earlier Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. and opens an hour later on Sundays at 8 a.m. Scenario D, which we added this week, has no changes to weekday hours or late night closing times on Friday and Saturday, but it does push back openings on Saturday to 9 a.m. and on Sunday to noon, closing the system at 11 p.m. on Sundays. For each scenario on the next slide, and I do apologize about the readability of this on the screen, but hopefully on your tablets it shows up a little bit more clearly. It's a lot of content here, but for each scenario you can see the number of riders impacted by the changes to operating times, the annual ridership impact, and then the hours of track work gained under each scenario. Management's recommendation is clearly focused on minimizing the number of riders adversely impacted by earlier closing times or later closing times while maintaining the additional hours of track access needed for our workers to get out there and complete their tasks. As a companion measure, Metrobus is developing multiple late-night service scenarios for the public to consider and comment on that we appreciate the board looking at. Those scenarios would include covering missing links, adding more late-night bus routes throughout the region, providing additional service to certain rail stations, and increasing service frequency to improve convenience for riders. The public outreach for this matter obviously would incorporate the full range of public participation plan activities, including advertising, in-system messages, outreach to community-based organizations, pop-ups in stations, surveys online and in person, and so forth. Also, we would conduct the compact-required public hearing for people to participate in person and develop a complete service equity analysis using data from the recently completed 2016 ridership survey, which is Metro census of all riders, which is collected about the ridership. If the board decides to approve this action, it really just begins the conversation with our riders and stakeholders and collects feedback for the board's consideration. On October 1st, we would propose to open the public comment period, conduct a public hearing the week of October 17th, close that comment period October 24th, and then the board would receive the public hearing and Title VI equity reports and a final list of recommended rail service hour and bus schedule changes for consideration in the December timeframe. A decision at that time would permit management to provide adequate public notice of changes, allow the communities we serve and special event organizers who are already looking a year forward to what they can provide to participants to plan accordingly, and provide time for management to schedule employee assignments to fulfill these new service requirements. Any changes would not take effect until July 1, 2017. In coming to the board finally with this recommendation, I just want to restate that management's proposal has really taken into consideration three key objectives. One is safety, obviously, getting 8 hours more out there on the tracks to do the work necessary to ensure the safety and reliability of the service. Two, service, and that is reducing any adverse impacts on the number of riders to the greatest extent possible, and that drove the options that you see. And then lastly, fiscal prudence, because this track maintenance work requires a great deal of equipment movement, contractor movement, and workforce movement. And those schedules and those assignments need to be done well in advance and done efficiently so as not to drive up overtime and other expenses at a time of budget constraint. Thank you, and I will certainly happy to take your questions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Bowerstocks. Before we have discussion, this is an action item, so I would ask for a motion from the floor for the resolution as was presented to us in our paperwork. Is there a second? Okay. I'll open the floor for discussion and welcome, obviously, Chair Hudgens to the meeting. Do you have any initial questions?
I'd start out, yes, I did want to start. Thank you. I wanted to thank General Manager and staff for making this proposal to us, and I think you outlined a long-term piece that starts us on a path of recovering the maintenance that's needed. And in the proposals that are given due to the General Manager, all of these scenarios give you your needed number of hours that you want to put back to the system. That's the given part here.
Yes, they do.
And so when we look to analyze each of these as to how we get them, how they will best make the service delivery we now have under the restructuring best for our customers and balancing the revenue piece as well. And so those are the pieces that we're looking at. Okay. I'd stop at that point until I have questions.
Okay, we're just going to go around. Okay. Mr. Dorsey?
Thank you, Mr. Augustine. So, we appreciate that from your initial proposal. You've added three subsequent scenarios of potential options, but it does remind us that there are probably plenty more options that you could consider in order to meet what appears to be the goal of about an additional 8 times 5, 416 hours in additional track time throughout the year. In addition to the closings that you've outlined, there are also considerations about when you single track at a point in the night to get you more hours, whether you continue what we've done with Safe Track and do periodic and targeted shutdowns and more intensive work. Why the four that you've come up with and not other permutations? I recognize that could get really complicated and messy, but the other goal that you have about not disrupting customers seems like other options could be less disruptive to a total number of customers, and I'm just curious as to the thinking into what we're seeing right now.
Sure. I'm looking at, we do about 700,000 passengers a day, so I'm trying to minimize it by basically looking at the shoulders of the operation period when the ridership goes way down, so that's obviously led us to the shoulder periods. I think the most important thing to keep in mind here, what we're talking about with this extra 20% of time is doing the basic preventive maintenance and inspection. This isn't the heavy lift type stuff that we're doing with Safe Track, which then leads to, okay, well, maybe you can single track or you can shut down and do bus bridges and things like that. That's not what this is about. This is getting at the core issue that we've got repeatedly from the FTA and from NTSB and other people that have looked at this system, which is the reason you've gotten to the position you're in is because you haven't done the basics, and you don't have a program to do the basics. You're not given enough time to inspect quality inspections, and you're not doing just routine maintenance. And it's everything. It's just not track. We've been focusing, obviously, the last few months on track. This is literally everything that we potentially touch. And that's why you need that flexibility, in effect, to be in the entire system and have the time to do it and do it right so that we get on a program where we know what's out there and we're maintaining on a routine basis all the things we should be maintaining. And then we will still have major things that we have to tackle. So, for instance, the radio communication system. That's totally different from this effort. You'll still need effort. You'll need major track time to do that. The other one that I was thinking of, which I just lost, the station lighting. Another one that I hear quite a bit about. What are we going to do about the stations? When you think of the station lightings, you have the lightings in the middle of two tracks. When you have side platforms, in effect, you're shutting down. So all that's different than this effort. This is just to do what we should have been doing for decades, to be frank, and to have a program that sets that in place.
Mr. Lobby?
Yes, a couple questions. You're talking about doing more inspections during this period. Right now, I believe the track inspections are done during the day and the maintenance is done at night. Are you talking about moving that inspection process, like track inspection,
yeah,
to the middle of the night?
Exactly. I'm going to look at it. But it's not only track. It's everything from drainage to
all the inspections to move them out of the service windows, right?
As much as possible, because what we've found is when we try to do that in service, we're not getting the quality that we want or the time that we need.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a reasonable idea, because it is quite challenging to do inspections during service as is done now. The other issue that I'd just like to address is with the 20% additional time, what does that mean to your workforce, your maintenance budgets, everything else? If you have an extra 20%, do you have the money, the personnel, the equipment to take advantage of that? And on the system as a whole, take advantage of that additional 20% every night?
Yeah, I think actually we'll be more productive with the resources we have, because basically right now we're trying to squeeze that with the resources that we have, and then a lot of times they're basically waiting to get track access, and we're paying for those people to do that. Again, as you may know, when we shut down between midnight and 5 a.m., we're getting maybe two and a half hours of real work, and the rest of the time is setting up and setting down, and reopening, and this gives us that ability obviously to get more productive work out of the workforce that we have under contract.
So you're looking at really improvements in efficiency and productivity.
Exactly.
Thank you.
You have a question?
Thanks. Good morning. Sure. This is kind of a follow-on to Mr. Dorsey's questions, but it's a very specific question regarding public outreach. Are we asking the public to comment on these four options, or are we asking the public, are we presenting these four options, asking for comments on the four options, but also willing to hear other possibilities, other strategies?
It's the latter. So we present a range of options to the public, we ask for comments, and we will consider any new ideas. The idea here is, though, to define a docket that the public can react to collect all of the public's comments for the board's consideration, and then the board can move forward with any idea. It's just that if it hasn't been presented in this outreach period, and if it hasn't been included in the Title VI equity analysis, it precludes the board later from considering it.
So if that is the case, I would probably have to provide a few more technical details on the requirement itself, because as it's defined, it's 8 hours the entire system. And I'm not interested in debating whether that's what the need is, but for both the board and the public to understand a little bit more about what that means, whether, you know, because there will be questions about the entire system or not the entire system, things like
right.
that.
And so the docket would provide a public presentation that drills that down.
Great. Thank you.
Does that mean you actually have a question, Mr. Folger?
I have a lot of questions.
Everybody doesn't have to have a question. I know that, Mr. Chairman,
I have
we're going on. Okay. Mr. Trying to keep it going.
Look, I've asked this question about the window and our inability to get in and out of our the maintenance windows, and FDA is saying we're only using 90 minutes to an hour or 2 hours on our maintenance windows, and I don't see how this is going to help us at all. If we can't logistically get in and out of these opportunities now, how are we going to do it later?
I've seen the report that the FDA has mentioned. It's one of the priorities that we're looking at is to – sorry. Can you hear? It's be one of the priorities I will have. Okay. Sorry about my cold. I apologize. But it's one of the priorities I will be setting. Yes, we have some issues that we're dealing with. The roadway worker protection is first off, it's critical for running service and for our employees. I think there's improvements that we can make in roadway worker protection and to allow us better access. But when you think about it, you know, one of the things that we have to do right now is get our trains laid up before we can get our prime movers into position because you have a two-track system. So we're looking at ways that we could maybe change that, get our prime movers and our work trains out a little bit sooner in the late PM rush so that we can begin work or expedite the work much better. It's a little bit of both. It's making sure that we have a defined window that our customers are aware of. Okay, that's important, and I think when we talked before about can you do things like early outs, can you do things like track surges, when you look at general maintenance, it's almost geographically difficult to do. You'd be sending our customers, you know, they wouldn't understand it. You know, they wouldn't know coming in tonight where we actually work. So the idea is having a defined window. Once we define that window, is then, yes, looking at the efficiencies we can do work with our roadway worker protection to expedite our work and get down there.
So you're telling the board that we're going to double our efficiency on the maintenance windows?
I don't think
because
don't
we're think not hitting – we're not using our maintenance windows effectively now.
I don't know if I use the word double, but what I'm just saying, yes, there are improvements that we can make, okay, and it's one of the things my staff is looking at along with Pat Lavin's group, is how can we efficiently use the work window that we currently have.
Which we're not using right now. Agreed?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so how much are we using of our opportunity now? What percentage are we using our maintenance window at the current time? FTA is saying we're only getting 90 minutes to 2 hours, and that's like half.
I don't have that.
At the most.
But I know we can be
okay,
more efficient.
Second question, sorry. There's nothing in here about late night bus service. Where are we on that? Is that going to be on the docket?
The bus planning staff are developing various proposals that allow us to replicate certain services based on ridership and where they are, and to offset some of the adverse impacts of some of the rail closures. Right, so we'll have different levels.
There's an idea that if we shut down Station X to Station Y, we run buses from Station X to Station Y. Will that be on the docket?
Yes. So what I would expect you to see is sort of low, medium, and high bus service options that have different routes, different layers of coverage based on ridership, based on demands, and that would have different cost implications associated with them.
And time.
Yes.
We would expand the late-night bus service on the docket in terms of time.
Well, bus service runs almost 24 hours a day
in
most locations, so it wouldn't be a matter of expanding their hours of service. It would be a matter of expanding where those buses are operating to more replicate the
Interested in, Len, is the workers who service our economy in the city, Washington, D.C., who have to get home and don't have another car, and
they
will not have any other way of getting from, let's say, a restaurant, a hotel, to home.
That's right. So we would put a bus option out there that would hopefully respond to at least most of those needs.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Bolger.
Thank you, Mr. Augustine. Mr. General Manager, I fully support your need for the additional 8 hours, and I will be supporting that after we hear from the public and as to which scenario. I'll wait to hear the public docket before deciding which one I would support among the choices. But I do want to just raise a question about the need for the 8 hours with Mr. Lederer, and then provide a suggestion for Ms. Bowersox to consider following up on Mr. Bulger's concern for the workers downtown. In looking at the need for the additional hours, I had asked our Maryland Department of Transportation to come up with a comparison of what are the current hours of service for other peer group systems across the nation right now. And what I find is that some of them are actually have longer hours of service now than what we're proposing. For example, Chicago, the CTA, starts at 4 or 5 in the morning and goes till 1 a.m., 7 days a week. SEPTA in Philadelphia, which is just a two-line system, Broad Street, and Frankfurt Market, starts at 5 a.m. and goes to midnight, but even on Friday and Saturday nights, operates 24 hours. The MBTA in Boston system is more like us, which starts 4 or 5 to midnight. So my question is there something unique about the WMATA system, why you need these extra hours of maintenance time overnight to do the work, as opposed to Chicago and Philadelphia? Or are we so backlogged in have underfunded the system and under-maintained the system for the last 10 or 15 years, that we've really got a backlog that we have to catch up on? I'm trying to understand what's going on.
You know, as you know, I brought in a number of people from other properties, so I'm having that experience brought in. But what I'm looking at is what I have in front of me. And what I have in front of me is basically a system that we do not maintain and inspect the level that we should. It's been, again, repeatedly noted in the most recent, you know, the track integrity investigation. They quoted, you know, almost 18,000 outstanding defects that we're not getting on top of. You know, that's what I have in front of us. So it's great to learn what other people do and, you know, learn lessons from them, whether it's Boston or New York or Chicago or Philadelphia. But the reality is what we have in front of us requires this level of time to get in there and do it correctly.
Okay. Over the next few months, I'd appreciate if staff could provide us some insight into why these systems can operate to track systems with this shorter amount of time, you know, unless they're not doing it well or not doing it right. But I think it's important to understand what's going on in these other systems.
I agree. And again, we brought in some outside, again, people from other properties to, literally, we've had peer reviews from those very properties to see what they do to best learn that. But again, with what we have in front of us, this is why we're recommending what we're recommending.
Thank you. Well, Ms. Bowersox, following up on Mr. Boulder's suggestion, in trying to find solutions for getting the people home at past midnight that are downtown, and your data shows that most of those people are originating trips to downtown in D.C., in addition to looking at what we can do as Metro, why don't we reach out to providers like Uber and Lyft and see if we can't contract with them to provide a kind of service where, you know, we've asked them to provide vehicles at the key downtown stations, Gallery, Metro Center, I'm thinking DuPont, and U Street. We'll provide them places, you know, in our bus stop lanes where they can keep their cars, you know, ready to go, and provide them some kind of pool service, which is probably going to be more convenient for the people that are down there to get home rather than running a 40 or 50 passenger bus out from, you know, D.C. to Montgomery County or across the river in Virginia. You know, maybe we don't have to always rely on Metro in-house to solve our own problems. It may be that our objective, I think, should be getting these people home late at night or where they want to go and not necessarily figuring out whether we can do it on Metro. So I would encourage you over the next couple months to look at that kind of option and begin those conversations with the Uber and Lyft people, whether they'd be wanting to enter into some kind of arrangement where we could use them as an ancillary service to get these people home. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Goldman. I think it's also, though, important to share that I was also obviously a part of the information that you're talking about, and that the MBTA or the T in Boston has a very similar schedule to us, and that they close at midnight, and that also that the BART system in San Francisco also has a similar system where they're closing at midnight, and they have these hours of service now within their framework to be able to do the kind of safety work that they're talking about. So there, we do have peers that are similar to that. Is there any other comments coming this way? Yes, sir.
Yes, quick comment. On the bus, late night bus service, could you include in your analysis, and maybe you're already doing that, but if we are to replicate the rail service with the bus service, okay? So everywhere the rail runs right now, if we were to close early, close at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, whatever it is, and ran a bus or buses from one station to the next station to the next station all the way around, what would it cost, and, you know, what does that look like? Okay, so replicate the rail system with bus service late at night. Okay, and number two, so the board and the public understands what the board's role is in this. After all the public comment and all the input, my understanding is the board can do something less restrictive and not more restrictive. But what does that mean exactly, as far as what the board can do at the end of this exercise? And can we come back with a hybrid that's none of these four things, that is something else, and what restrictions are on that?
Chairman, before she answers that, I actually asked that very question to our council prior to this. And our council assured me that, and obviously we're here doing it in a public forum, we can take this information. And obviously, really, the proposal here is for taking 8 hours out of service. That's really kind of the heart of the proposal, taking those 8 hours out of service. We receive that information. We then will have the latitude as a board to do any hybrid or anything that does not go beyond that kind of that framework. So we will have that. She gave me that assurance prior to this meeting. So I just wanted to answer that, and then they can answer however they choose.
I definitely agree with our council and your representation of her advice. I would just caution, though, that any hybrid that you do has to then go through the equity analysis for Title VI so that the board is fully informed about the impacts to low-income and minority ridership. And so then the board can make a decision based on that. And I would also say that there's a requirement for public notice of anything that we've changed. So it would change the schedule, but it's certainly not precluded.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to have an information request. I would like to have included in here the cost of incremental cost per hour of operations. I've heard a couple of different numbers, but for instance, I see here 8,000 riders would be impacted between midnight and 3 a.m. If it cost $80,000 to operate the system for an hour, it may be cheaper and we may save money by paying for an Uber ride for everybody. I'm just right, throwing that out as an example. I don't really know what that cost per hour is, the incremental cost. And the second is, I would like to see what efficiencies can be picked up in an incremental 4 hours or 5 hours versus an incremental 8 hours. I think we're just seeing 8 hours or zero right now. What would be the increases in maintenance efficiencies with 4 hours of increases? I think it ties into what the chairman was saying, but I'd like to see that. Thank you.
Thank you. Support.
Quick question. Does this proposal include the possibility of doing as we do now, which is to allow an entity that is provided, for example, if there's a late baseball game or something like that, that an entity could pay to provide later service, or is that option going to be precluded by this?
I think we have to be extremely careful. Again, we have to set up a program where we constantly inspect and maintain the system. And if we keep chipping away at those errors to do that, I think that's very dangerous. So, I mean, I think we have to look at that individually. I don't want to commit to it right now.
So if I'm understanding, you're saying that there would be no guarantee, but that we might consider those things on a case-by-case basis?
Exactly. Okay.
Sir.
First of all, I want to preface my questions with, reminder that with the previous regime, I was asking for a proposal along these lines and kind of pleading with them about need for more maintenance windows, and was told that was not necessary. But at the same time, I do think that there's a high threshold that management has to justify such a dramatic change. And I do want to clarify that, the peer agencies, do not require maintenance windows of 41 hours. Boston, 28 hours. Atlanta, 30 hours. San Francisco, 34 hours. LA Metro, 22.5 hours. So this is unusual. It's not kind of within, I think, the range of our peer group, but if there's exceptional circumstances that require this 8-hour addition, I think we need to know what we're getting for that. I'm not sold that 8 hours is the magic number. Even today, we're hearing somewhat contradictory information from management as to what the purpose of the 8-hour addition is. Is it, as the general manager said, for inspection and routine maintenance, clearing of drains? Those are activities which, I think would not be tremendously labor-intensive and capital equipment-intensive, or is it, as the COO has described, to get prime movers and heavy equipment into position to be doing, major infrastructure work? It's a bit of a black box, this 416 hours. What is actually going to be done in that time? I think it would be helpful for us to understand that in terms of actual investment. SafeTrax has been described as $120 million initiative by your manager of budget. Is that the level of expenditure that we expect to see on track infrastructure indefinitely, $120 million a year? That's twice what you have budgeted in the past of $60 million. Is that what we're to expect? Or is this more just, as you said, inspection work? It'd be helpful to understand the labor hours that we're talking about and the types of activities that are going on, in this 41-hour period of time. So that leads to the question of why permanently? Why aren't you asking for an additional 3 months or 6 months or 9 months? You already have 39 hours right now. Why is this a permanent change? And then secondarily, it seems like we have a lot of information that's being developed, information about improving efficiency of our crews, but that's a work in progress, as Mr. Leader just described. We're still looking for capital needs inventory. That's something that we won't have until December. Why now? Okay, so two questions. Why permanent, and why now?
The why now is because of the public hearing process and the board requirements that we have hold public hearings. So that takes time, as Lynn's outlined, to do that. So that's why we had to start that. Associated with that is if we do any change, we have to have the labor and the picks coincide with that. So that takes time to organize that. So that's why we have to start now thinking about this issue.
Well, I've looked at the calendar related to the picks, and I've looked at the calendar related to the signage changes and the brochures that you have to print and all that stuff. And it seems like there's a lot of time in 2017 to make this adjustment, but we have to make a decision with imperfect information 11 months in advance.
We can provide more information. That's why we want to start this now. We can get more information to you. But literally the process requires, when you start backing it out, that we've got to move on this relatively quickly to get it out there so that we can have the discussion.
Okay, what about this? The other question about permanency versus the temporary nature of what you seem to be describing. I mean, are we going to be kind of locking in the inefficiencies that Mr. Bolger is concerned about by giving the management team and the crews, you know, this liberal period of time to work on the track, as opposed to focusing on getting people in and out of the work areas swiftly and safely?
No, it's all of the above. It's not an either-or situation. Yes, we can be more efficient, but again, with the scale of what we have in front of us, and repeatedly have been by other professionals looking at the system from across the board, saying you do not have enough time just to do the basic work, much less the major work that you have to take on.
Hold on. Okay. You have a question? No? Okay. Yes?
I think this plan really puts us back into really trying to deliver the system in a safe as well as an efficient way. And I recognize that it will have a great impact on our users, and I think we should be concerned about its cost. But if we think about how the system was originally built and was delivered, we progressively changed the model to deliver the service on the extended times without changing how to do the maintenance. And I say that having heard a prior general manager very clearly state, if you change these hours too drastically, we lose time for maintenance. I would be more comfortable using what is before us today and thinking through how we could efficiently give back that time, and then think long term, what does the system need to go back to the kinds of hours that we've had in the past and be safe, but also be economically viable as we want this region to be. Those are the two balances I think we have to think about here. And I think it is drastic looking at having to cut those hours back. But I know quite well that we removed a lot of time from maintenance. And it isn't just the recurring conditions that grow onto a system. It's what needs to be done on a regular basis in order to put what is there back to an efficiently run system. So I can't speak to the peers as much, but I only know what we have here, and I think I know what we're facing in terms of the safety and the cost. The cost is drastic as we lose revenue because we're not delivering the service as efficiently as it can be and as quickly as it can. So I would hope that we would think about this, and then we could work through it. Maybe in a different way, there are many things that must be done to make our system more efficient anyway. We still have challenges of effectiveness in terms of delivering the service. So I think we need to go back to maybe point A.
Thank you, Ms. Hodgins. I'm going to call the question. As we are having, obviously, it's an important discussion. We are here today, actually, to talk about authorizing a public hearing to further this discussion. These are all obviously great comments and questions that we have. We can obviously follow up with that and participate in this as an ongoing process. So I'm going to call the question. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Okay, opposed? All right, thank you. The ayes have it. I think that concludes our business for today, and we can call the meeting to adjournment.